The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
For the last few minutes of the sitting, I'd like to suggest that you take a resolve of stillness of the body. See if you can refrain from any intentional movement to change posture or move your limbs. Not as a way of forcing yourself to sit still, but more as an exploration of the urge to move. So if you notice yourself wanting to move, notice that you can notice that desire before the movement happens. And hang out with what it feels like to want to move. Notice the reason you want to move. See if you can just hang out with that feeling of wanting to move. And notice what happens to that feeling as you observe it. If you find that the urge to move gets overpowering, allow yourself to move, but do it mindfully. Know that you're going to move, and move slowly so that your awareness can take in the sensations of movement. So I'm curious, what happened for you when I suggested that you be still? Did any of you have the urge to move and notice what that felt like? Yeah. Oh, and the microphones, yeah.
Almost to the second that you said that, I felt my knee start hurting, and I wanted to move my knee. It was amazing. I don't know which came first, but I didn't do anything, so it just seemed to go away. But it was just a curious thing to, the minute you mentioned noticing that moving, of course, then there's like reciprocal action that occurs, so that, oh, I must want to move something, and, oh, my knee hurts, you know, within many seconds, milliseconds, rather. So, but it didn't, that just passed.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually keep quite still anyway. I just sort of do this back shifting if my back starts to hurt. So it wasn't especially challenging, but maybe on a different day it might have been.
So when you noticed that your knee started hurting, what was your experience then? I mean, was there a sense of wanting to move? Or
there was a bit of a panic. Because I thought, oh, I've gotten a direction now not to move. And so, you know, you take it real literally. Oh, she says not to move, so I can't move. And I didn't want to because I wanted to see what it felt like just to honor that.
Uh-huh.
But then I said, well, but I can move if I want to. I don't have to sit still. If it hurts too much, I'll move. You know, sort of in rapid succession, those thoughts come. And so once I decided that was true, then it didn't, then I think it just didn't make any difference anymore.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so it was kind of like the request for stillness or the resolve for stillness almost tightened you up, which created some kind of pain. And then when you realized, oh, but that it's just an idea, I don't have to sit still, then it loosened again.
Right.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's not an uncommon thing to happen. Did anybody get a sense of what it felt like to want to move? Anybody have a strong urge to move and just hang out with that feeling of wanting to move? So part of the reason for this exploration is that it points to, at least I hope some of you got the sense of this in the exercise, it points to the fact that you can know that you're going to move, or you can know that there's an inclination to move before movement happens. This is actually a key point in our practice. The fact that we can know we're going to move, we're going to speak, even we're going to think before we think. And I mentioned this a couple of times in the last few weeks, but tonight I'm going to explore this quality in a little more depth, a little more detail. So I'd like to ask you, because I did bring this up around your projects, you know, when I suggested the looking at something that happens regularly throughout your day, I said at some point you might begin to notice it's that you're going to do that thing before you do it. So for instance, if you picked standing up or walking through doorways, that at some point you would begin to recognize that you were going to walk through a doorway before it actually happened, or that you were sitting at your desk and you realized that you were going to stand up before it actually happened. Has anybody noticed that? Has anybody been able to experience that aspect of the of these exercises? Okay, so keep looking, keep practicing. Keep working with those exercises. I'll talk a little bit more about the how that works. But tonight I'd like to explore partly why this is so helpful for us. So most of you probably have the sense that there is an interrelationship between our minds and our behavior. That when we feel something in our minds, when we have some kind of an emotion or some kind of inclination come up in our mind, a feeling of frustration or anger or love or compassion, that it often will prompt some kind of a response in our it'll prompt some kind of a physical response or some kind of a speech. So we're very familiar with this connection in the way that, you know, if we have something come up in our mind, that it can reflect in what happens in our bodies. So when our minds are peaceful, we behave peacefully. If we're angry, we often act out in that anger. But this interrelationship actually goes both directions. So it's not simply that if we are experiencing some kind of a peaceful state in our mind that we behave peacefully. Behaving peacefully will have a rebound effect on our minds. Or if we act in an angry fashion, it will have a rebound effect on our minds. So this interrelationship goes both ways. The way we behave influences our mental state. Sometimes it seems like we don't necessarily trust this direction of the relationship. We have a strong sense in this culture of being true to who we are. You know, if I'm feeling angry, then I should express it. Or if I'm feeling peaceful, of course, that's what I'll express. But true to who we are means that whatever's happening inside should get expressed somehow. And we don't necessarily trust. We feel like it's somehow being false or to dissemble if we are feeling angry, but we behave peacefully and calmly. So we don't necessarily trust that direction of the relationship. We feel like it's being insincere or false somehow. Somehow we think that in order to be peaceful, that we have to have the change happen in our minds before it can happen in our bodies. The bridge between our minds and our bodies is a quality called intention, which is this quality that I was pointing to in the at the end of the meditation, that we can know we're going to move before we move, we can know we're going to speak before we speak, we can know we're going to think before we think. So this quality of intention is essentially the link between mental activity and physical activity. This intention itself is kind of a neutral quality. It's simply a kind of an urge or an impulse to do something. But accompanying that impulse is a motivation, a reason why we want to move. So, for instance, if you're sitting in meditation and taking this resolve of stillness, you might notice an itch. And then sitting there watching this urge to scratch the itch, there's a sense of aversion, of dislike, of wanting to get rid of that experience. And that's the motivation. That dislike, essentially, is the motivation for the wanting to move. So each intention has an accompanying motivation. And there's many different kinds of motivations that we can have. We can have a lot of our motivations are based in some kind of wanting something to happen, wanting to have something, or sometimes some kind of wanting to get rid of something. That's a large part of our motivations of why we do things in the world. We either want to manipulate the world so that it will be what we want it to be. But there are also motivations of compassion, of generosity, of kindness. So there are wholesome motivations as well, skillful motivations that we can touch into as we start looking at this link between mind and body and the reason why we move, why we speak, why we act. So as we begin to understand the bidirectional nature of this relationship between mind and body, we can use it to our advantage in terms of cultivating skillful behavior and skillful mental qualities. So we can choose to behave peacefully, honestly, compassionately, even if we're not particularly feeling that way. If we behave peacefully, honestly, compassionately, with patience, whichever quality you're working with at the moment, with the intention, kind of directing the intentional quality of the mind to cultivate the state, the internal state of patience, of honesty, then that behavior has a rebound effect, and it will cultivate that quality internally. We need to know this is an actual practice. We can't simply, if we're feeling angry or feeling impatient, I'll use impatience, that's one that I have been working with quite a lot lately with this particular practice. So impatience arises, and the practice is to, for me, I notice often that when impatience arises, I move a little more quickly, that I kind of start throwing things around or just like not being so careful about how I move my body. And so part of the practice for me of cultivating the physical patience is to slow down my bodily movements. And I know this is a practice. This is like I'm doing this in order, so I've recognized impatience has come up in my experience. I'm in my kitchen kind of throwing the dishes in the shelf. Okay, I see the impatience. and then intentionally slowing down my body to behave as if I were patient with the intention to cultivate patience. So it's linking that intention to the action. And I have been quite amazed with the power of this practice, that if I simply slow down and behave as if I were completely patient with the intention to cultivate patience, patience arises. And it actually comes fairly quickly, within a minute. I'm feeling more patient, more calm. So we can, using this understanding about intention and our body, the kind of relationship between mind and body through intention, to actually cultivate beautiful qualities of mind. Acting peacefully cultivates peace. So that's a little bit about, you know, the kind of mechanics of intention. And I'd like to explore this quality tonight from a few different directions, both in the moment-to-moment exploration of experience and in the larger choices that we make. Because a lot of times our motivation, our intentions, they are occurring in a moment-to-moment way. With every act of body, speech, or mind, there is an intention that arises. But there are also larger intentions of our lives. We have larger intentions to accomplish larger goals, to go to graduate school or to find a new job. And those intentions, it's helpful to look at motivations and purpose behind the larger intentions as well as the more moment-to-moment intentions. So the first place I'd like to explore this quality of intention and motivation is through the Buddhist teaching about non-harming. I think I've talked about this in this evening, and I'm just kind of talk about it briefly tonight. One of the main teachings about this non-harming is in a teaching that the Buddha gave to his son when his son was 7 years old. So this teaching is a teaching that a child can understand, but it's not a simple practice. When I look at it, it's quite a challenging practice. He suggests to his son that before he does an action, he check and see whether it will harm anyone, whether it will harm himself or another, or both. And if he sees on reflection that it will not harm anyone, or that he doesn't see that it will harm anyone, he should go ahead with that action. If he sees that it would cause harm, he should refrain from that action. And he doesn't stop there. He says, while you're doing an action, check and see, reflect, is this causing harm now to myself or another? If it is, stop. And he doesn't stop there. He says, after you have done an action, check and see, did it cause harm to yourself or another or both? If it did, confess it, open it up to a companion in the holy life. So this is like basically talking to another. He is suggesting to his son, talk to another monastic. Talk about what has happened. And undertake restraint for the future for that action. So basically what this is teaching us, there's a couple of aspects of this teaching that I like to highlight. The first is reflection. That it's encouraging us to reflect on our actions and reflect on the intention of non-harming. This is one of the key intentions that we cultivate, the key motivations that we cultivate as we move in our spiritual life. The intention of non-harming, the motivation of non-harming. As we make this reflection and look at our behavior and the consequences of our behavior, how it impacts ourselves and impacts others, we learn from our experience. So essentially, it's a way of becoming our own teacher, using this guideline of non-harming. The guideline of non-harming is kind of the foundation of our practice, that when we are behaving in a way that does not cause harm or does not cause suffering to self or other, we are behaving in a way that frees us from suffering. It's a skillful action to behave in a way that does not cause harming. So in this practice, we also gain wisdom, because one of the main definitions of wisdom in the Buddhist teachings is understanding what is skillful and leads us away from suffering, and understanding unskillful actions and how they lead us into suffering. So this reflection, repeated reflection on our actions and whether they cause harm, is a way of learning from our experience. The other piece that I like to highlight is the reviewing aspect, particularly at the end. Because it may be that our intention was one of non-harming, but harm has resulted. So at that point, we need to look a little more deeply at what is happening. Is there something that we didn't understand, something we didn't know? And can we see that thing we didn't know clearly so that we can undertake restraint in the future? There's kind of a poignant story about this. This kind of thing. This is a story about an environmentalist, David Brower, the founder of the John Muir Institute. He tells a story of one of his earliest adventures as a naturalist. At the age of 11, he collected some eggs of the western swallowtail butterfly and kept an eye on them as they hatched into caterpillars, which later turned into chrysalids. Finally, the first of the chrysalids began to crack open, and what Brower saw was this. The emerging butterfly struggled out, its abdomen distended by some sort of fluid that was pumped out over its wings as it hung upside down on a twig. Half an hour later, it was ready to fly, and it took off. As the other chrysalids began to crack, however, Brower decided to make himself useful. He gently eased open the crack to facilitate the butterfly's emergence, and they promptly slid out, walked around, and one by one dropped dead. He had failed to realize that the exertions he had spared the butterflies were essential to their survival, because they triggered the flow of fluid that had to reach their wings. This experience taught him a lesson that he was talking about 70 years later. What appears to be kind and is meant to be kind can be the reverse of kind. So we need to learn from our experience, look more deeply. If we see that harm has resulted from our actions, can we learn and understand what we didn't understand? So this kind of reflection another area to look at intention and motivation in is in the practice of dana, of giving. Now, there's an external and internal component to this practice or to this quality. The external is the act of giving, just that action. The internal quality that it cultivates is generosity. So actively giving cultivates that internal quality through this link of intention. So it's really helpful when we give to look at the intention, the motivation with which we are giving. What is our mind like as we are performing this action? What is our mind like as we give? And there are ways that we can give and support that cultivation of the internal quality of generosity. So again, intention and motivation is how giving translates into the internal quality and feeling of generosity. So in looking through the Buddhist teachings around generosity, I found that there were actually quite a few teachings around the manner of giving, essentially giving from the heart, that giving from the heart is skillful. And there's a list, there's several lists actually, of reasons why we might give. I'll read some of them to you. We might give out of affection, anger, stupidity, fear, because of tradition. We might give because someone else has given us a gift. We might give because we hope for a gift in return. We might give to gain a good reputation. We might give because it's considered a good thing to do. We might give because we want to help others. Or because we want some kind of a result from that giving. And in this case, it talks about wanting a good rebirth. We give because we want our next life to be a better life. We give because it will gladden the heart and the mind. And we can give because it ennobles the mind and supports our ability to let go of greed, of aversion, of delusion. So it's helpful to notice the intention with which we give. And this can be in many areas, in areas you wouldn't even think of the act necessarily being a gift. If while you are offering something, or even throwing something away, the sutta said. Here's a quote that I love. Even if one throws away the rinsings of a pot or cup into a village pool or pond, wishing that the living beings there may live on them, even this would be a source of merit, not to speak of gifts to human beings. So even throwing away your garbage, if you wish that beings may live on this, that's a way of cultivating that quality of generosity, because it's an act of knowing and noticing that what I'm putting out there may be of use to somebody, and actually making that wish, may this be of use. So a simple example that we can all connect with, perhaps, is when we're driving on the freeway and somebody's coming in and wants to pull in front of us. Instead of pulling up to close the gap so they can't get in, can you back off and think of it as a gift, an offering? May you have an easy merge on the freeway. Even those simple things support that cultivation. It's the intention in the mind. It's moving towards that intention to express kindness, express generosity. There's another teaching in the Pali Canon about giving with integrity. And I'll just read a few of these. It says, a person of integrity gives a gift with the conviction that it supports letting go, with the understanding, the confidence that giving supports letting go. A person of integrity gives a gift with attentiveness, gives a gift respectfully, gives a gift without adversely impacting himself or another. Now this one is interesting, I think, because this points to looking at what our own needs are as well as the other. So this comes down to looking at priorities. So this is a beginning to look at the larger area of intention. What are my priorities for my life? So giving needs to be balanced with wisdom. We can't simply give away more than we have. And there are differences in means between people, so we can't compare ourselves to what others are giving. We need to look for ourselves. What is skillful for me in this moment in terms of giving? We can reflect on giving as a way of looking at the resources that we have to offer to ourselves and to others. And how do we want to use these resources? Our time, our money. How do we want to use these resources? And looking at what our highest values are. Are the way we use these resources in line with our highest values, our highest ideals? This can be a good thing to reflect on. How are you using your resources? And how does it reflect what you value most deeply in your life? We have an opportunity through giving to direct the flow of our resources, to nourish what we hold, what we have value in, to support its growth. And giving from a place of conscious reflection like this, you may well feel nourished yourself in knowing that your resources are supporting what you value the most. So looking at intention and motivation in terms of non-harming, looking at it in terms of giving and how it supports cultivating generosity, and its connection to our larger motivations in our lives. Then there's looking at intention and motivation in a moment-to-moment way, which I mentioned earlier tonight. There's one quote. By Padmasambhava, who is the sage who took Buddhism to Tibet. He said, "Though my view is as vast as the sky, my attention to motivation is as fine as the grain of barley flour." So paying attention moment to moment, what are the motivations moment to moment? These moment-to-moment motivations essentially add up to what the consequences of our lives are. The moment-to-moment choices we make impact whether we experience greater happiness or more suffering. So if our larger intentions are noble, but the way we go about it, accomplishing that larger intention, is through a series of movements of greed and aversion, that is going to rebound on us at some point, and we will suffer others will suffer. So the larger intention, looking at the skillfulness of our larger intentions and how they are brought into being moment to moment as we act in our lives. So we can begin to explore this in our daily lives. And a great way to practice with this is in that activity that I suggested you work with. In the regular activity you look at throughout your day, I suggested you pick something that is an intentional action that you do. Standing up, walking through doorways, clicking send on the computer for email. Something that you take an action to do. And as you begin to explore this, you'll start to recognize before you do the action that you're going to do it. And you'll know what's going on. You'll probably know in the moment of knowing that you're going to do it before you do it, you will know the reason. You will know the motivation. Similar to the way I spoke about speech, and this is another good place to practice with this exploration of intention, when I suggested pausing before speaking. In that pause, you are catching, essentially, if you can pause before you speak, you're catching that intention to speak. And in that moment, you can know what you're going to say and probably the motivation or the reason why you're going to say it. So we can explore this quality of intention and motivation in our daily lives. And as we can see that point, as we can see that moment of intention, essentially it gives us a choice. It gives us a choice about whether we want to follow through on that motivation. So in speech, this is, again, like I mentioned, I think a couple of weeks ago, this is a really great thing. I mean, all of us, I know every single one of us has had the experience of saying something and 2 seconds later wishing, oh, I wish I hadn't said that. This kind of practice gives us a window of opportunity to notice, oh, if I say that thing, that's going to cause suffering. It's going back to the teaching the Buddha gave his son. Reflect for a moment before you act. Is this going to cause harm? If we can catch this moment of about to, sometimes this moment of recognizing intention, people call the about to moment. We're about to move, about to speak. We can catch that moment. We have an opportunity to choose. Do I follow through on this or not? If we see that our motivation will cause harm, we have a possibility. We have at least a possibility of choosing otherwise. Now, we can't always, even seeing those intentions, we can't always choose otherwise, because sometimes the momentum of our habits is so strong that even though we see it and we know it's going to cause harm, it's like there's just so much of momentum behind that habit or pattern that it just blurts out, or that action happens anyway. And so we need to practice with the consequences. Undertaking restraint in the future, making amends, perhaps, maybe immediately recognizing, oh, I shouldn't have said that, I apologize. If you can recognize this and make amends, that goes a long way towards healing the rifts that come when we act unskillfully. There's another teaching that is more about looking at intention in the larger sense. It talks about how our actions, the reasons we do things, how they come in line with our larger goals. This is a teaching called the teaching on clear comprehension. And I talked about this in March, so some of you may have heard parts of this before. I'm just going to review part of this teaching on clear comprehension. The teaching on clear comprehension basically points to understanding how our day-to-day activities support our understanding of the truth of the Dharma. So it helps, this understanding of clear comprehension helps to turn our actions towards purpose and efficiency, towards something that is meaningful to us. Now, if this sounds restrictive, to turning our activities towards purpose and efficiency, think of how often we feel at odds when we're kind of just wandering around doing things without a sense of purpose, and how much more meaning and satisfaction there is in our lives when we are doing something that is directed towards a deeper value, a deeper purpose, something that has meaning to us. So there's two main types of clear comprehension that I'd like to talk about tonight. There are four in the teachings, but I'm just going to talk about two of them tonight, and they are called the clear comprehension of purpose and the clear comprehension of suitability. These are primarily about the content of what we do in our lives. Now, in meditation practice, we often talk about letting go of the content. You know, forget about the content, just what's happening right now. This teaching is about engaging with the content. So in the Buddhist teachings, there's not simply a let go of everything in terms of content, in terms of, you know, the day-to-day meaning of things. Here's a teaching that directly addresses how we can relate to content. So purpose, the clear comprehension of purpose, is about how the practical purposes of our everyday experience relates to our highest aspirations. Are our activities in accord with our ideals? Now, this is similar to what I was talking about with generosity. The way we use our resources. So the way we use our resources in accord with our highest ideals. If we think of our activities as a resource, this can fall into that category. Are we using our activities in a way that supports our highest ideals? So a simple example might seem a little silly, but just think about going to the grocery store. The going to the grocery store has a kind of an obvious purpose of buying food for yourself and your family, and that's skillful. That's a skillful thing to support that. And we might incline towards other skillful intentions in that activity. For instance, meeting the people in the store with kindness. You know, as we get ready to go out and act in the world, can we connect to an intention to behave in a way that connects with our deepest aspirations? So even going for a walk, just people you come across, can you engage with kindness, with friendliness, with compassion? And looking at the larger impact of the choices we make, the food we buy, is it truly nourishing food? What's the impact on the environment of the choices we make? Just looking at where your what you like to support, what you like to move towards, how you would like not just yourself, but the larger community to move towards. And making choices in line with that. In this exploration, we are probably going to find that we don't always act in our true interests. We sometimes think we're acting in our best interest, and that may be a kind of a short-term kind of interest. You know, what is going to make me happy today? Or what is going to make me happy tomorrow? What's going to make me feel good? Versus what is moving towards the goal of freedom from suffering. There's an interesting quote I found. This is from Warren Buffett. "We never want to count on the kindness of strangers in order to meet tomorrow's obligations. When forced to choose, I would not trade even a night's sleep for the chance at extra profits." That, to me, is looking at what might be your best interests as opposed to your true interests. It's kind of a skew of an understanding. It's a not understanding. So sometimes we can't prevent ourselves from not acting in our own true interests. Again, the habits, the motivations, the patterns that we have built up over our lifetime are very strong. They're really powerful patterns. And the practice of mindfulness is not necessarily to force ourselves to behave in a certain way. Although, as I said, that can be powerful. If we can behave in a certain way and intend to cultivate the skillful qualities, that can be very powerful. But sometimes we just can't do that. And so when we can't do that, the practice is to observe. Observe what is going on. Observe our motivations. Observe the consequences with compassion. One teacher, a German monk, Nyanaponika Thera, who wrote a commentary about this teaching on clear comprehension, said, he has this beautiful phrase, he says, "We aim for a peaceful penetration of the irrational regions of our minds." So we don't try to force those irrational regions into doing something. As he says, we aim for a peaceful penetration of the irrational regions of our mind. We do this through mindfulness. So clear comprehension of purpose doesn't mean that we can't relax, that we can't enjoy time with friends. It does suggest that we look at our motivation as we engage in these activities. Is this serving a skillful purpose right now? Or is it trying to avoid something? Is it trying to get away from something? So looking at our activities in line with what are our deepest aspirations. And mixed motivations will exist. You will see there are times when you have both skillful and unskillful motivations going on. When I find this happening, I like to kind of try to highlight or land a little more heavily on recognizing the skillful part, even though I know the unskillful part is there. Just recognizing, well, okay, you know, that unskillful part is there, but there is a skillful motivation here. So I'm going to kind of focus on that as I take this action. As we begin to really touch into the consequences of behaving unskillfully, and we begin to understand our suffering, understand how it impacts us, how it impacts others, the true purpose of life becomes more clear. The true purpose of letting go of those actions that lead us into suffering. Here's a poem. by, it's excerpts from a poem, not the whole poem, by Naomi Shihab Nye. When they invite you to the party, remember what parties are like before answering. It's not that you don't love them anymore. You're trying to remember something too important to forget. Trees. The monastery bell at twilight. Walk around feeling like a leaf. Know you could tumble at any second. Then decide what to do with your time. A related teaching on the clear comprehension is the clear comprehension of suitability. So I talked just about the clear comprehension of purpose, which is trying to align our actions with our deepest ideals. Clear comprehension of suitability acknowledges that we can't always behave in an optimal way, especially in our daily lives, in our lay lives. We can't always behave in a way that would maximize our behavior towards reaching our highest aspirations. So Nyanaponikatera calls this learning the art of the practicable. So what is practicable with respect to the choices that we can make now? And how can we engage in our activities, if they're not optimal, in a way that supports the direction that we want to go? So for myself, I have had an exploration about this in the past few years. My life is pretty well committed towards the practice, towards going on long retreats, towards teaching, towards the Dharma. And yet, I needed to support myself and earn a livelihood so that I could pay my bills and buy food and buy gas and all the things that we have to do. So I've been a technical writer. I was a technical writer for a number of years. And in my exploration of this, I began to see that I didn't have to resist that being a technical writer. It felt like, at times it felt like it was taking me away from what I wanted to be doing. It was taking me away from Dharma study. It was taking me away from time I could be on retreats. It made it less easy for me to teach as much as I wanted to teach. And yet, it supported my ability to do these things as well. So earning a livelihood through the technical writing supported me to be able to go on retreats and to teach and to pay my bills. So it was practicable. And I could connect with that activity as being supportive of the direction I wanted to go. And that's a skillful way to approach our lives. Essentially, it's like a reframing. As opposed to struggling with or fighting things that we know we have to do. Reframing them as supporting our movement towards what we most aspire to. So essentially, I've been talking around this topic of motivation, intention, skillful and unskillful. And this is essentially, I've been talking around the Buddha's teaching on karma. The teaching, karma translates as action. And the teaching on karma is a teaching on cause and effect. When we behave in ways that are skillful, where skillful means supportive of qualities that are non-greed, supportive of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, those actions tend to lead us out of suffering. When we behave in ways which are motivated by greed, aversion, and delusion, those actions tend to lead us towards suffering. And this isn't a particularly judgmental thing. The Buddha talks about this. He says, this is just the way it is. It's not good or bad. It's just the way it is. If you want to be happy, look at how greed, aversion, and delusion get in the way of happiness. See if you can let go of those motivations. I'll close with another poem. This is by a Tibetan scholar. This human body, at peace with itself, is more precious than the rarest gem. Cherish your body. It is yours this one time only. The human form is one with difficulty. It is easy to lose. All worldly things are brief, like lightning in the sky. This life, you must know, is the tiny splash of a raindrop, a thing of beauty that passes away even as it comes into being. Therefore, set your goal and make every day and night a time to attain it. Treasure the time you have been given, for this is all that matters. So we have just a couple of minutes if there's anyone who has any comments or questions. Yeah.
So kind of related to what you mentioned about the noticing the intention behind giving, just earlier today, right before I came, actually, I was having a chatting with a friend online, and he was feeling kind of down and I think worried about how his coworkers viewed him as a leader. And I think I wanted to reassure him. So I said, oh, well, you know, I'm sure they are proud of you because, you know, you set a good example and you work hard. And then he said, oh, thank you. Like, oh, that's very kind of you. And then that made me stop because I was like, well, I think my original intention was to reassure him. But then after he said that, I was like, was there something else? Was there another motivation? Like, did I say that because I wanted him to think of me as a nice person, you know, like, and then it kind of went around in my head. I started doubting my intentions and I was questioning my motivations. I just felt kind of like a lot of confusion about that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you know, we can do that. You know, we think of something as, okay, you know, this is going to be, you know, reassuring, but then we see, oh, well, maybe there were some mixed motivations. You know, we can simply just notice, well, maybe there were some mixed motivations. Not trying to go back. I mean, essentially, it sounds like what you were trying to do was to go back and figure out, what were you feeling in the past? And it's gone. That moment is gone. You can't really go back and figure that out. So, you know, just letting that go and acknowledging to yourself, maybe there were some mixed motivations. In the future, as I engage with people, at least see, you know, is there some of that coming in? And again, with mixed motivations, it's not necessarily to not engage in that action. It's more to say, okay, yep, there's mixed motivations in here. I see there's this movement to want to reassure this person, and there's also this movement to want to get something in return. You know, this wanting to be seen as a supportive person or something. Just recognize that that's there. You don't have to not do the action because that's part of it. But see if you can kind of land more on the side of the non-selfish motivation as you engage in it. Making the selfish motivations apparent in our minds is the doorway for them to release. You know, if they're not seen, we don't have the opportunity to actually come out. A lot of things, you know, we experience as we're doing this mindfulness practice, we see a lot of things we don't like about ourselves. And that's part of the function of the practice. It exposes things that we were not so aware of. As we engage in this practice, we're kind of, delving into what was previously below the level of consciousness. you know, that we weren't really able to see. The more and more we observe our behavior, our motivations, the more we actually begin to see the underlying causes for our behavior, which is what we typically think of as coming out of the subconscious. And we can actually see a lot of that. And as we see it, it leads to it, the possibility of its releasing. So it's not a problem to see those things. In fact, it's good to be able to see them if we can not judge ourselves for those things. And we all have them. You know, it's just part of being human. So we need to stop. So this week, just see if you can check into your intentions. And how what you're doing relates to your deeper motivations of your life. So thank you.